The following is brought to you by Echo Weekly.
Good afternoon. My name is Sean Rosen. I am the owner and publisher of Echo Weekly. My voice does not lend itself. Voice does not lend itself to radio commercials. The reason? Each commercial is approximately 30 seconds. Echo Weekly, free every Thursday.
Welcome to Terra Informa, your weekly dose of environmental news. I'm Rebecca Rooney, and I'll be your host for the next half hour, so let's get started. This week on the show, Steve Anderson brings us coverage of a national protest against construction of a pipeline to pump oil from the oil sands deposits of Alberta to the BC coast. Marcus Peterson brings us an inspiring interview with Dr. Swaminathan, hailed the father of India's Green Revolution. And I chime in with an eco-babble defining what is meant by the term biomonitoring. But first, here's Brett Taggart with the weekly roundup of environmental news headlines.
I'm Brett Taggart with your wrap-up of the week's headlines. The computer search giant Google is investing in offshore wind development along a large chunk of the East Coast. The proposed project will cost about $5 billion over 10 years to build a string of deep-water transmission lines that would run up to 20 miles offshore from Virginia to New Jersey. Often one of the most expensive parts of renewable energy projects, transmission lines are crucial to the growth of clean energy. After all, there's no benefit to an offshore wind farm until that energy is delivered to your home. The 350-mile Atlantic Wind connection will start construction in 2013. It will be able to transmit 6 gigawatts of energy from offshore wind farms, enough to power about 1.9 million homes. The first phase, which will run 150 miles from New Jersey to Delaware in federal waters, will be capable of delivering about 2 gigawatts of wind energy. It will be completed by 2016 and cost about $1.8 billion. Google will be one-third owner of the project, while investment firm Good Energies, Japanese company Marubeni, and Maryland transmission company Transelect are splitting the rest. The combined initial investment in the project runs in the tens of millions of dollars. A recent report from the U.S. National Research Energy Laboratory says that the U.S. could get 20% of its electricity from offshore wind energy by 2030 if wind farms are developed along the coast and in the Great Lakes. The province of Ontario may have already passed its point of peak coal use and is now on the downward slide as it increases its use of renewable energy production. Last week, the provincial government announced that it had permanently closed 4 more coal-burning power plants in the province. Electrical generation from coal peaked in 2003, and atmospheric pollution levels are down significantly since that point. According to the Green Energy Act Alliance, citing government figures, sulfur dioxide from power generation sources is down 81%, nitrogen oxides are down 77%, and carbon dioxide emissions are down 71% since the peak in 2003. Coal generation of electricity in Ontario is at its lowest level in nearly half a century. In the same period, more than 8 gigawatts of renewable production have been added to the province's power supply. All of Ontario's coal power production is targeted to be eliminated by 2014, and greenhouse gases in 2011 are predicted to be two-thirds lower than they were in 2003. Last Monday, Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban announced that the police have arrested Mal Ritt, CEO of Zoltan Bacconi, on criminal negligence charges for that company's role in last week's major chemical spill. Prime Minister Orban also announced an emergency law allowing the government to take control of the plant from which the spill originated. The chemical spill occurred October 7th when one of the plant's reservoirs cracked, releasing nearly 200 million gallons of toxic sludge, killing 8 people, injuring hundreds more, and contaminating thousands of acres of woodlands and farms. If convicted, CEO Bacconi faces up to 11 years in prison. The chemical plant has resumed production following the reinforcement of its dam. Health Canada scientists have just concluded a 4-year study of bisphenol A, commonly known as BPA, and their findings have prompted the federal government to list BPA as a toxin. BPA is widely used in industrial processes and have been found in hard plastics, the linings of metal food and beverage cans, as well as in coatings, adhesives, and sealants in machinery. Earlier this year, a United States study found BPA in 40% of paper receipts given at retail, causing concern among retail workers. Canada's Environment Minister Jim Prentice announced that Canada had added bisphenol A to Schedule 1 of the Canadian Environmental Protection Act on Wednesday in a press release. Listing the chemical as a toxin allows the government to develop stricter regulations to ensure the chemical will not adversely affect the environment or human health in the future. And that was this week's environmental headlines. Back to you, Rebecca.
Thanks for that, Brett. If you're looking for more info on any of the environmental news stories Brett covered, check us out online at terrainforma.ca. If you want more frequent updates, you can also subscribe to our Twitter feed, because we're hip like that. This past weekend saw rallies all across Canada protesting the proposed Enbridge pipeline. When completed, the pipeline is intended to carry crude from the Alberta tar sands to the BC coast to be shipped overseas. Concerns have been raised over the impact of building the pipeline, the threat posed by tanker traffic through BC's sensitive coastal waters, and the fact that the project will be supporting the tar sands, which have a long list of environmental problems of their own. To make matters worse, much of the pipeline will be traveling through unceded First Nations territory. Opponents to the pipeline held rallies in Toronto, Vancouver, Edmonton, and Prince George. Our correspondent Steve Anderson attended the rally in Edmonton, where he spoke to some of the participants.
Shut down!
Justice!
Shut down!
Tanker!
Shut down!
Pipeline!
One more time! Shut down!
Tar sands!
Shut down!
Tanker!
Shut down!
Pipeline!
That was the sound in Edmonton's Gazebo Park this past weekend. Protesters gathered to voice their opposition to Enbridge's proposed Northern Gateway pipeline. The pipeline would carry tar sands crude from refineries near Edmonton to Kitimat on the BC coast. From there, tankers would transport the oil down the west coast to the U.S. or across the Pacific to Asia. As Rebecca just mentioned, there is no shortage of concerns surrounding the project, and the protests weren't limited to Edmonton. Vancouver saw a huge rally, complete with a flotilla of boats that traveled along the tanker route. The Port of Vancouver already sees 2 oil tankers a week, and Greenpeace representatives say it will soon increase to 10. In Edmonton, the rally included a number of people who spoke about the risk posed by the pipeline and the effects the oil industry is already having on their communities. Here's Errol Deranger of the Rainforest Action Network speaking about the full reach of the tar sands industry.
So we're here today because we're standing in solidarity with actions that are happening in Toronto and Vancouver tomorrow to really pay close attention, to bring the public's eye on the fact that we are going towards catastrophic climate change by really going forward and pushing projects like the tar sands. The tar sands aren't just here in Alberta, and we can't ignore how big and how far it stretches. From pipelines that go to the west coast, to the south, down into Texas, near Florida and Louisiana, tanker traffic being proposed off of the west coast of Canada and down the west coast of the United States to California. They have proposed pipelines piping gas, natural gas, from the Northwest Territories, with propositions to take that one step further to Alaska and up into Canada's Baffin Islands. This project is, by no stretch of the imagination or exaggeration, the largest industrial project on the planet. It's time for us to say no to tar sands, no to tankers, and no to pipelines. I also just want to let you know that Enbridge has a nasty, nasty, nasty record. Not only are they building one of the largest pipelines in Canada, they have a track record of spills. You can go on Wikipedia and you can see the track record of all of their burst pipelines, all of their leaks and spills, their contaminations, and what they've done. This is not a company with a good track record. They will try and sway you and say, oh, we have investments in wind and in solar. If that's the case and they want to be a clean company, then it's time for them to get out of the tar sands. It's time for us to say no to Enbridge. It's time for us to say no to tar sands. Thank you so much, Musi Cho.
Next, Dustin Johnson spoke. He's a campaigner with the Sierra Club of Canada and a member of the Tsimshian Nation on the northwest coast of BC, one of the nations that would be impacted by the proposed pipeline.
Hello everyone, I just wanted to thank you for coming out. I just wanted to talk about what's happening with the tar sands pipelines that are going to be expanding to the BC coast if they're approved. There are seven pipelines. Enbridge Gateway is the biggest pipeline. There's two dual pipelines crossing over 1170 kilometers, which would cross 1,000 rivers, streams, and lakes, and nearly 50 communities. This pipeline is also followed by three other pipelines, and that includes Kinder Morgan, a TMX leg of their northern pipeline, Pembina pipeline, and KSL pipeline. Gale force winds that occur on the BC coast go up to 150 kilometers an hour, and if any of those pipelines burst or those tankers spilled on the Pacific coast because of the pipelines being built, the spill would spread rapidly because of that, because of the strong winds. And those tankers are 10 times the size of what happened in Exxon Valdez. And they estimate over 1,500 tankers would be traveling that coast per year if just one of these pipelines are built. So people need to be made aware about what's going to happen if these tar sands projects are approved. We need to find a more sustainable path for future generations so that we don't create more of this toxic legacy that we're living with, that we're leaving for our communities. These communities are not in favor of these projects. And the more and more people are made aware of this, the more and more communities, especially west of Prince George, are unanimously opposed to Enbridge and all these gateway pipeline projects. That's all I had to say.
That was Dustin Johnson of the Sierra Club. Now, unfortunately, just due to time, it's not possible to include everyone who spoke, but I do want to play a clip from one last person.
My name is Misty Potts Sanderson. I come from the Alexis Nakota Sioux Nation. We are one of the corridor communities for the tar sands. The Enbridge pipeline is going to be going through our traditional territory. I was just driving by with my niece, actually, and I saw you guys, and I was inspired to stop here and talk because this is my line of work, and this is something that I find that in a community, it's really difficult to try to say no to the beast, the economic beast that destroys our people, because they buy our people. We have no knowledge of what's going on. We don't have the Western scientific knowledge to be able to understand what it is that we're presented with from these companies. And every time they talk to us, they say no adverse impacts. But what they don't realize is that when they destroy the land, they destroy us. You know, they destroy our medicines, they destroy our animals, they destroy our people, they destroy our identity. Everything that we are as Iska, I am an Iska Wia, Nakota woman. Everything that I am comes from my traditional territory. It comes from Mother Earth. My songs, my way of life, my very being. And if that ever stops, it's going to be because of that, you know. And I feel really strongly about what you people are doing, and I'm happy to see that people out there outside of our communities are standing up to the government for us and standing up to industry, because it's really difficult in the community. If we do it, we lose our jobs. If you say no, you lose your job. If you say no, you lose your student funding. If you say no, you know, you don't get picked for a house in the next list. So there's a lot of things that happen to us if we say no. But if we start to live the way the Creator meant for us to live, then I think that it would be a good thing, and I think that we are on the precipice of change. And I'm very happy that you people are out here and generating some knowledge and generating some noise. And Ishnish Pinamat for letting me speak. Say no!
Tar sands!
No.
Tiger.
No.
Pipeline.
And no consultation.
That was Misty Potts Sanderson, one of a number of people who spoke at a rally against Enbridge's proposed Northern Gateway pipeline this past weekend in Edmonton. For Terra Informa, I'm Steve Anderson.
Thanks for that, Steve. You're tuned in to Terra Informa, radio news for the environmentally inclined. We're now broadcast from coast to coast to coast across Canada, so we may be firing along radio waves anywhere from Sydney, Nova Scotia to Vancouver, BC. But if you missed our local broadcast, never fear. You can always listen to us at your convenience by downloading our podcast or streaming the show from terrainforma.ca. Inspired by India's independence in 1947 and driven by a desire to see his country hunger-free, Dr. Swaminathan has led the global movement in bioengineering food production. He led the agricultural revolution of the mid-60s that literally ended India's food dependence and avoided the imminent famine that many experts were predicting. Considered the father of the Green Revolution in India, Professor Swaminathan has been recognized as one of the 20 most influential Asians of the 20th century, and one of only three Indians by Time magazine. He believes that true progress towards food security for the planet must be through a pro-nature, pro-poor, pro-women, and pro-sustainable on-farm and non-farm livelihood. He is regularly consulted by the United Nations on food security issues and is globally recognized as a prominent advocate for social change. He currently leads a prominent research foundation that takes scientific research from the laboratory to effect positive change at the village level. He recently received an honorary doctorate from the University of Alberta and delivered the Bentley Lester Pearson Memorial Lecture entitled Food Safety and Security in an Era of Climate Change. Terra Informa correspondent Marcus Peterson caught up with Professor Swaminathan while he was in Edmonton for that lecture.
Dr. Swaminathan sparked an agricultural revolution in India in the 1960s when he pioneered techniques to crossbreed a dwarf Mexican seed with Japanese seeds and local Indian varieties of wheat. As head of the International Rice Research Institute in the Philippines for 7 years, Dr. Swaminathan and his colleagues then used the same techniques to modify rice seeds with similar results. From research to implementation, he nearly single-handedly helped to prevent the death of thousands of Indians in what was then perceived to be India's inevitable decline into famine and poverty. In 1972, Dr. Swaminathan was one of the founding members of the International Crops Research Institute for the Semi-Arid Tropics. This organization was set up to help developing countries in semi-arid tropical regions apply science to increase crop yields. He then founded the Center for Research on Sustainable Agriculture and Rural Development, now the M.S. Swaminathan Research Foundation, where scientists work directly with farmers and their families. He is a fellow of the leading scientific academies of India and the world, including the Royal Society of London and the National Academy of Sciences in the United States. Dr. Swaminathan also co-chaired the United National Millennium Task Force on Hunger from 2002 to 2005. He also served as president of the Nobel Peace Prize-winning Pugwash Conferences on Science and World Affairs from 2002 to 2007. With the world seemingly reaching, as journalist Richard Heinberg puts it, peak everything, food security will become one of the greatest challenges facing humanity. However, no viable alternatives to our current extensive factory farm-style form of food production seem to be able to deliver the same bang for our buck. Although bioengineering and genetic modification technologies have been heralded as panaceas to our food woes, unforeseen health problems and emerging concerns over biodiversity losses have put a significant damper on their potential. I discussed some of these challenges and opportunities in an era of climate change with Dr. Swaminathan. Do you anticipate another green revolution? Is it possible?
I call it an evergreen revolution because green revolution was coined by one Mr. William Gaud, G-A-U-D, of the U.S. Department of Agriculture in 1968. He coined it to show that now a revolution is taking place in the farm in terms of productivity improvement, yield per hectare, not area. Formerly, the production was going up through area expansion. The yield didn't go up. As a result of the semi-dwarf varieties of wheat or rice or hybrids of corn, you suddenly found that production is going up not because of area expansion, but of vertical growth in productivity. That is what's called Green Revolution. This original Green Revolution had some negative repercussions, environmental, because a lot of groundwater was overexploited, the soil got salinized, and monoculture led to new pests and diseases. The number of problems, biodiversity was affected. The other problem was economics of farming. If farm ecology and farm economics go wrong, nothing else will go right in the farming. The economics was because the petroleum products was going up. So fertilizer price was going up, pesticide price was going up, and small farmers found it difficult to buy the costly inputs. But inputs are needed for output, and therefore there was a problem. This is why I coined a term called Evergreen Revolution. Evergreen Revolution means improvement of production in productivity in perpetuity, not up and down, without ecological or social harm. Social harm in terms of equity in access to technology, or also gender, woman. There's a growing feminization of agriculture. So the woman's role and how to strengthen them, how to provide them support services like creches, daycare centers for children, because women gender-specific needs are there in terms of support services. So all of them has to be done. That is what I call Evergreen Revolution, because otherwise second Green Revolution, third Green Revolution, and so on, you can go on. But in most countries, most of the developing countries, including my own India, there is no more land for agriculture. Even if we are able to hold on to the land already in agriculture, that will be a great achievement, because land is going out of agriculture all the time. And therefore, we have no option except to produce more from less land. And that means it must be done without environmental harm. This is why the word Evergreen Revolution was coined.
Do you believe that those principles of the Evergreen Revolution of sustainable development, can they be implemented on a global scale, even with oncoming climate change?
They have to be implemented only on global scale, because local, national, and global scales. Because globally, in fact, already there's acceptance. A few years ago, the 50th anniversary of the American Society of Agronomy and Crop Sciences, the theme was from the green to an evergreen revolution. They recognized the importance of mainstreaming ecology and equity in technology development and dissemination. And therefore, the concept has gained ground, and globally it has to be done through green agriculture. It will also require new technologies like space technology, biotechnology, and information technology. Those also have to be integrated. Otherwise, you will not be able to achieve productivity in perpetuity. You require control of new pests and diseases. You require more control of efficiency of water use, efficiency of land use, and so on. But we have uncommon opportunities for productive agriculture and a hunger-free world.
Do you see that in the future, rising oil prices and oil scarcity impacting scientific breakthroughs and advancements in biotechnology or ecotechnology?
Biotechnology has many dimensions. There is tissue culture, micropropagation. They all come under biotechnology, but the hardcore of biotechnology is what we call recombinant DNA technology or genetic modification. That has opened up completely new opportunities for transferring genes across sexual barriers. Formerly, I am a breeder, I am a geneticist. All my work was done only by what you call Mendelian breeding, conventional breeding. We have to use both of them in the appropriate way. Don't discard the Mendelian genetics because it's old. or worship the molecular genetics because it's new. What is important is, under a given circumstances, how do we develop? The bottom line must be the farmer's well-being, the farmers and their stable income, and also the well-being of the consumer in terms of community. So if you use that as the bottom line, human well-being is your bottom line for technology adoption, then you will use biotechnology in an intelligent way, in a way which is a responsible way, and take into account potential negative factors like human health safety or environmental safety, impact on biodiversity and so on. So we need when you have got a very powerful technology, ethics becomes very important in the use of the technology. So you need a biotechnology regulatory authority which inspires public confidence, political confidence, professional confidence, media confidence.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All the
best.
That
was great.
If you want to hear the rest of the interview and Dr. Swaminathan's lecture entitled Food Safety and Security in an Era of Climate Change, please go to terrainforma.ca. You can find these extras, among others, under the Bonus Features and Content tab. For Terra Informa, I'm Marcus Peterson.
Thanks, Marcus. If you're just tuning in, this is Terra Informa, a weekly news program dedicated to environmental news and issues. Maybe you're catching us riding the airwaves across Canada, or maybe you're streaming us live from our website, terrainforma.ca, where you can find all kinds of additional information and bonus content. We often hear the term biomonitoring used in conjunction with assessments of ecosystem health or integrity. Biomonitoring is a popular form of environmental monitoring. The term is short for biological monitoring and refers to the measurement of changes in biological communities in order to assess the health or impairment of an ecosystem. Biomonitoring has several advantages over traditional physical and chemical monitoring, but the two approaches are generally considered complementary. While chemical or physical variables provide a snapshot of conditions at the immediate time of sampling, biomonitoring is able to integrate conditions over time, with timescales depending on the life history of the organism being studied. Physical and chemical variables may provide information about the environmental stresses that act on a system, but it is typically the biological responses that most people are concerned about. In other words, if sulfur dioxide results in acid rain deposition, but that acid rain has no detectable effect on the plants or animals, most people don't consider it a big problem. Typically, biomonitoring focuses on fish or invertebrates in aquatic systems and on plants in terrestrial systems. But certain species are also monitored because they are of special concern, rather than because they are believed to indicate something about the overall health of their habitat. For example, there are numerous bird monitoring programs in North America that monitor annual population changes in songbirds or migratory birds, in part simply because people like birds. For every species listed in the Canadian Species at Risk Public Registry, there is some form of monitoring being carried out. However, the majority of biomonitoring is carried out in order to assess habitat quality, rather than out of concern for the specific organisms being studied. Biomonitoring can measure impacts of cumulative stressors, including impacts from chemical interactions, contaminant pulses, or unknown contaminants that are difficult to capture with routine chemical sampling. Other stresses that may be captured by biological monitoring include the presence of exotic species, habitat degradation, climate change, and fluctuations in water quality. Overall, it is an important component of any monitoring program, and the next time you hear someone talking about it, you'll know what they mean. Well, that wraps it up for this week's show. If you have questions or comments about anything you hear on Terra Informa, look us up on Facebook or send us an email at terra@cjsr.com. I've been your host, Rebecca Rooney. Till next time, stay green, folks.